Well, as Brother Rogers said, I waited many years to be able to say, as Brother Rogers said, and to have someone in the chair that I could say that to. It certainly doesn't happen very often, but of course Mary was one of the disciples, wasn't she? And the story today is how she became a disciple of Christ. It's always nice to have a study on a lady, isn't it? Because we don't often have studies on the women of the Bible. And this is a very special one, because remember that this particular woman was chosen by God to bring forth Messiah to Israel. She must have been a remarkable young woman. That out of all the young virgins of Israel, God selected this girl to be the mother of his son. It must have been something very special about Mary. And in fact, what we're going to find is that despite the fact that she was a wonderful person, a unique person, that she had a problem, like all the other disciples. And the story of our study today is to see the way in which she had to work through that problem, and that only in overcoming that problem could she become wholeheartedly, finally, fully, completely a disciple of the Lord. Actually, I'm quite sure that Mary would turn over in her grave if she knew what had happened to her through the Roman Catholic apostasy and the principles of Mariolatry and the counting of beads and the reciting of prayers to Mary. We all know, by the way, or at least I hope you do, that what's the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, by the way? Now, be careful. What is the Roman Catholic doctrine of the Immaculate Conception? Yes, is that right? The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is that that Mary was immaculately conceived, and the reason, of course, is because she brought forth Jesus, and Jesus is God, and therefore for a woman to bring forth God, she must have been absolutely pure herself to have produced God, and therefore she herself had to be immaculately conceived, and so one error propounds itself upon another. And so we have a whole lot of hideous nonsense these days preached on and believed on in the name of Mary, which I'm quite sure that poor old Mary would be most distressed to know about. In fact, so much so that if you go to Spain today, you can actually see Mary's house from Nazareth in a certain Roman Catholic city in Spain. And this is the real house from Nazareth itself, which apparently flew to Spain and is now a holy Roman Catholic shrine. And no doubt a great deal of money is made inviting people through as well. So that's not the Mary we're going to look at today. The Mary we want to have a look at is the Mary of the Bible. A wonderful girl, but a woman who grew up with a particular problem that she had to struggle with. And I'm sure you'll find as we go through that problem that you'll have a sympathy for Mary as to why she had the problem. It's a very natural one, a very understandable one for her to have. Well, our story actually starts in Luke 2, just a little earlier, where shall we start? Perhaps in Luke chapter 2 and verse 22. It says, when the days of her purification, according to the law of Moses, were accomplished, they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every male that openeth the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. And to offer a sacrifice according to that which is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons, which tells us what, of course, about Mary and Joseph? That this was the offering of the poor. They were not a wealthy couple, spiritually rich maybe, but not augmented in the increase of mammon. And Simeon, who was in the temple, an old man, blessed them with these words in verse 34. Simeon blessed them and said unto Mary his mother, behold, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. Now you'll see the first part of verse 35 is in brackets. So what we should read is, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against, that the thoughts of many hearts shall be revealed. Now, one of the passages that I believe that Simeon had in mind was Isaiah chapter 8. If you come back to Isaiah 8 for a moment, not saying this is the only passage he was alluding to, by the way, but here's one of them, because when he says this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, he's taking up two key words out of Isaiah chapter 8 and reading from verse 14. And he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling, and for a rock of offence to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many among them shall stumble and fall. You see those key words there? Many and fall. This child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel. Now, what were they going to stumble at? Well, of course, Isaiah chapter 8 is part of the Emmanuel prophecy. And the thing, the doctrine that was going to cause stumbling was the doctrine of God manifest in the Son, Emmanuel, God with us. And certain people would rise to that doctrine and see that as the cornerstone of their faith, and other people would fall under that doctrine, not being able to understand it, and would stumble against the stone of Jesus. So you see, there was a fall or rising depending on how one reacted to the sign of Emmanuel in the nation. God shall give thee a sign. Remember, ask for a sign in heaven above or on earth beneath. God says, I'll give you a sign, and the sign, of course, is the sign of Emmanuel. So when Simeon says, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel and for a sign, I believe that part of what he had in mind was the sign of Emmanuel, the doctrine of God manifest in his Son. Whose child is this boy? God with us. You either rise to that doctrine or fall. And the whole of Israel would be divided, wouldn't they, into those two classes. Those that rose to an understanding of that principle, or that fell away from accepting Jesus Christ as the manifestation of his Father. Now come back to Luke chapter 2. So it's the teaching of God manifest in the flesh. That would be the doctrine that would divide people in Israel. Now you see what verse 35 says. Now we come to the bracketed bit. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also. Now that's what we're actually going to take up today. The sword that pierced the soul of Mary. That's what we're going to look at today. The sword thrusts that pierced the soul of Mary. And we believe that what those sword thrusts were related to is the very thing that others would rise or fall to, the doctrine of Emmanuel, God with us. Now, where else is the idea of the sword used? A sword shall pierce thine own. Where else is the sword taken up, and in what context in the New Testament? Two-edged sword dividing asunder, which is? Give me the full quotation. Can anyone give me the full passage? The word of God is quick and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, dividing asunder to the piercing. Right, so that's Hebrews chapter 4. So here we have the sword used in Hebrews chapter 4 as a symbol of the word. Anywhere else? Ephesians 6. Alright, what's that say? Matthew? And take the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. So here we have the sword used in Ephesians 6 also as a symbol of the word of God. So the sword is taken up as representative in the New Testament of the influence of the Spirit word. Now, however, that's what Paul says in Ephesians and Hebrews, but the Lord makes reference to the sword. Where does the Lord refer to the sword? Let's have a look at the Lord's own use of the term. Whereabouts is that? The Gospel of Matthew and chapter 10. Quite correct. Now let's come and have a look at the Lord's own use of this term. Yea, a sword shall pierce thine own soul also. Well, here's how the Lord used that. In Matthew 10 and verse 35, he says, verse 34, of course, "Think not that I am come to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword." Well, what's the sword? Well, he explains the sword in verse 35 and verse 36. "For I am come," you see, "I came not to send peace, I'm come to send a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, so that a man's enemies will be found in his own family," says the diaglot of verse 36. Now, what he's talking about, of course, is the influence of the Spirit word dividing between families. And down the middle of a family would the Spirit word come, slice. And some would rise to the doctrine of God manifestation, and others would fall away from that, and the Spirit word would exercise that influence right into the middle of families itself. And that was the sword that would pierce the soul of Mary as well. The influence of Christ's teaching as the Spirit word, which would inevitably divide families, that very same sword was going to touch her, was going to deeply affect her. Now, in verse 35, when Jesus says, "I'm come to set a man at variance against his father," do you think Christ would really do that? Surely Christ wouldn't come to set a man at variance against his father. So what does he mean? Is Christ saying that he would deliberately come in and break up families? Any thoughts on that? Yes, it wasn't that he was coming deliberately to break up families, but that the teaching of the Spirit's sword would inevitably have that effect. It wasn't that Jesus wanted to do that, was it? But that's what the influence of the sword would be like. It would divide between families. Wasn't that Jesus sought to do that? All he wanted to do was to preach the doctrine of Emmanuel. But some would rise to that and others would fall away. And in that very process of rising and falling, families would be divided by that Spirit word. Was the outworking of his work, was the effect of his teaching. Verse 37. Oh, now this is interesting. "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Now here's the problem, you see. He that loveth son more than me is not worthy of me. Now how could Mary apply that? Ah, now here's the problem, you see. Here's the beginning of the problem in Mary's life. He that loveth, or she that loveth son more than me. Now how could Mary work that out? Yes. Yes. See the problem here? Now here's the beginning of the problem in Mary's life. He that loveth son more than me. Now she already loved him as a son. But the problem was, she loved him as her son. She had to learn to follow him as God's son. And there's a big difference between those two. Mary herself had to learn the doctrine of Emmanuel, God with us. And therein lay the struggle for this woman. Because the whole problem that she had was her bond to that boy. You know, probably only a mother understands. You know, a boy grows up big and tall and strong, and before you know it, he's baptized and he's got a job and he's in the meeting, but Mum remembers the day she changed his nappy. Mum remembers when the first tooth was cut. Mother remembers the first little funny little walks through the lounge. And the cuddles that she used to get. Mum remembers counting all his fingers and toes when he was born to make sure that he was all there and all right. You see, mothers are made that way, aren't they? Mothers know. And mothers especially have a very strong attachment to sons. They love their daughters too, but sons are something else. And this was her son. Her firstborn son. And she loved him dearly. Now, can you see how this was going to be a problem for Mary? Ooh, what a really difficult problem this was going to be. And the whole problem for Mary was the teaching of the Spirit Word that was to divide her own family ultimately and to pierce her own soul again and again until she learned whose son this boy really is. And she was going to have a real struggle with this. Now, you might just like to take a note, if you're taking notes, and you all should be anyway, is you want to take a note of these key words. Because as soon as you've got these words, I tell you what, they just jump out of the narrative and scream at you, and you think, well, why didn't I see those before? And these five words are the key to the whole story. Because the whole of Mary's life's problem revolves around human relationships. And here they are. Here's the five key words. Father, mother, brethren, disciples, son. Right? They're all the words of relationships, aren't they? I'll read them again. Father, mother, son, brethren, disciples. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but hidden in those five terms are two different types of relationships. Mother, son, brethren. What sort of relationship is that? Flesh and blood. Father, son, disciples. What sort of relationship is that? That's a spiritual relationship. And this was going to be the basis of the conflict in Mary's mind that she was going to struggle with. And again her soul was to be pierced with the influence of the Spirit Word until she learnt that lesson out of the life of her own son. Well, here's the first sword thrust. Luke chapter 2 and verse 42. Just see how you can pick this story up once you've got those key words. Luke 2, 42. 41. 41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. They were a godly family, spiritually minded. They were observant of the feasts. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they had fulfilled the days as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. But they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions, and all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said unto him, now look at these key words, his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou dealt thus with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee. Now can you feel all the sense of mother here? Alright, you see what happens is when a child gets into trouble, mum gets worried. Mothers do, they worry about their children. And what happens is when the child comes home safely or is found safely, do you know what the mother really feels? She really feels an enormous sense of relief that all is well. And do you know how she shows her relief? She gives the child a jolly good scold. It's true, isn't it? All right? It's how mothers react. They're actually really very thankful it's all okay. But in fact, they say, now don't you ever do that again. You had mum quite worried. Now, that's exactly what Mary does here. But you see, she says, his mother said, Son, why hast thou dealt thus with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee. Son, can you see the mother bonds binding her back to her son here? All the terms of human relationships. And you see what Jesus said in reply, verse 49, a 12-year-old boy. And he said unto them, how is it that she sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business? Oh, that was a sword thrust, wasn't it? Don't you think Mary felt that? Because it was respectfully said, as no doubt we would expect. Jesus would certainly not have been disrespectful to his parents, but it was a repudiation nevertheless of, thy Father and I have sought thee. No, 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 says Jesus, my Father's business. That would have hurt me. Really hurt. That in the strange, beautiful, obedient child that she knew was different and always had known was different, but even now at 12 years of, there was something strange about him. He was their child, and yet he wasn't somehow. There was a strange distance between her and this boy already, a gulf that she couldn't understand. Verse 50 says, they understood not the saying which he spake unto them, and he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them, but his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. And she felt the first prick of the sword in the realization that this son was not just hers. His mother said, thy Father and I, son, know my Father's business. Well, the years rolled past. We tend to read from the narrative, if we read it carefully, we gain the impression that Joseph died reasonably early on into the marriage and the bringing forth of the children. And there was quite a big family, wasn't there? How many in the family, by the way? You'd like to add up the family? Well, there was Jesus, James, Joseph, Judah and Simon, and at least two sisters. So there was seven children in the family. It wasn't a small family. And it appears that Joseph died early on into the story because he disappears from the record very early on, and from then on we only hear about Mary. And of course, if that's true, then one can imagine that as the years rolled on and as Jesus came into manhood, that he would be leaned on more and more by his mother to solve problems with the other children. Jesus, could you attend to so and so and such and this and that? And she would lean on Jesus for guidance, wouldn't she? As we would expect. With a natural enough thing. But the day came when Jesus' ministry began and the call of God had come. And as Jesus strode away from the house over the hills and his mother waved goodbye to her with a tear in her eye, even she hadn't realized that he really had walked away completely this time. He was no longer her son. In some special sense, he had forever gone. He was now on his Father's business. But she had some more sword thrusts before she realized that that bond had forever been changed between them. And then the next story that we come across, the ministry of Christ has begun, and in John's Gospel record, and in chapter 2, we read of another occasion where Jesus comes into contact with his mother shortly after his ministry has commenced. We're told in John chapter 2 of the wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now it says in verse 1, and the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus is there. Now notice that Joseph isn't mentioned. You see, Joseph, by implication, is already gone from the narrative by this time. He's gone. But the mother of Jesus is there, verse 2, and Jesus. Now why would both the mother of Jesus and Jesus both be at a wedding? It's a family gathering, quite right. Flesh and blood relationships, you see. It's a family gathering, and here they are together. But it wasn't just Jesus and his mother. You'll notice verse 2 says, both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage, because Jesus is now a travelling rabbi and he's got a following. Now he's got disciples. In fact, the suggestion's been made that because Jesus was part of a family and he was invited to the wedding, but because he was a rabbi and had all these other people following now as disciples, that the family felt obliged to invite the whole of Jesus' entourage.
And because they'd invited them, the wine ran out because of all these extra people that had come. Jesus is a man of importance now. He's a teacher, got followers. And so they're all there as well. And so now we have this family gathering of the marriage in Cana of Galilee. Now, you see what it says, verse 3. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, they have no wine. Now, you've really got to read these records carefully. Remember how we said good Bible study is all about good Bible reading. Now, there's lots of things you can think about when you read the record carefully. Here's the first thing. Ladies notice things. All right? They do, don't they? Women have a more practical bent, a greater sensitivity to practical problems than men do. None of the men noticed that the wine had run out, but Mary did. Women sort of notice these sorts of things, don't they? And Mary would have, she didn't want that to happen because it was a family gathering, and, well, if it's a family wedding, you want everything to go well, don't you? You wouldn't want, you know, something like that to happen. And so she says, they've got a problem here, the wine's run out. And so she says to Jesus, they've got no wine. You notice how she's called, what she's called in verses 1 and 3. You might say I'm reading a little bit into this, but I think there's a sense in this. The mother of Jesus. Now, I know that's who she was, but don't you detect just a touch of pride there? Here's Jesus, the travelling rabbi, and all the disciples, and guess who else is at the wedding? The mother of Jesus. That's my boy. The rabbi, Jesus. You know, my son. Who wouldn't feel proud? Wouldn't you appreciate Mary feeling a touch of pride there? That Jesus was now a famous teacher. And so the mother of Jesus says, they've got no wine. And you see, for the last few years, she'd been used to bringing her problems to Jesus at home and leaning on him to provide a solution, as he always had. And perhaps now she expected, with the commencement of his ministry, that maybe he would perform a miracle, something special, to really make the wedding into an exciting occasion. Jesus said unto her, verse 4, here's a sword thrust. Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. Now, whatever we might think, the word woman here, by the way, in verse 4, the word woman is not perhaps quite as harsh in the Greek as it might appear in the English. And in fact, he's going to use it later on in a context where we would never ever believe that the Lord was being disrespectful. Don't think he was being rude here. Wasn't being nasty. Lord would never have done that with his mother. But the one thing we can say is this. The word woman is not the same as mother. He didn't say mother. He said woman. That's a more distant relationship, isn't it? He does not acknowledge her as mother. And you see, what he's saying is, look, he says, what he's really saying is, I am no longer subject unto you. The family tie is forever finished. I have begun my father's business. You can no longer presume upon your fleshly relationship to me. Woman, what have I to do with thee? And not only that, of course, but the powers that God had given him were for the advancing of his father's purpose, not his mother's. She had to learn that too, didn't she? Oh yes, Christ had the power to turn the water into wine, but it could only be done if it was in some way advancing his father's purpose, not because his mother ever asked him, and she had to know that. And you see what he says in verse 4? Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. And when his hour had come, what would he say? John 17. Mine hour is not yet come. And when the hour did come, this is what he said in John 17 verse 1. These words spake Jesus, and lifted up his eyes to heaven, and said, Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son. And when the hour of Christ came, it was to his Father that attention would be directed, not to his mother. But that hour hadn't yet come in John chapter 2 at the time of the wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, can you feel that sense of a sword that must have hurt Mary on this occasion? Yeah, they're all at the wedding. It's a family gathering. And there she is with Jesus there. What a marvellous thing for her to be able to see her son again and to ask for his help in the way that she's used to, and to have this sort of rebuff, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" A stern look. That must have hurt her. That was the thrust of the sword, because she still saw her relationship to him as a fleshly one. This is her son. And Jesus was endeavouring to teach her that he was not her son, not any longer. He was the Father's son, and on the Father's business. At least his mother nevertheless accepted the rebuff and had enough confidence in her son to, well, if you come back to John chapter 2, at least his mother had the wisdom nevertheless to say in verse 5, "His mother said unto the servants, whatever he asks you to do, do it." She accepted the rebuff, but instructed the servants to stand by nevertheless. And Jesus did perform a miracle, didn't he? But he made it clear that the miracle that he was performing was not because of his mother's request, but to advance the purpose of his Father. It would always be that that was the case. He was his son, not her son any longer. So what's the key words there? Mother, disciples, woman. All these terms of relationship again. And this time the emphasis is on a spiritual tie, that his disciples are there. This is a new sort of relationship that Mary doesn't quite understand, but she's going to have to grow in her understanding of that. Matthew chapter 12. Or you'll remember this story. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 46. Now here's one of these little stories where you've got to picture the scene again. Verse 46 says, "While he yet talked to the people, behold, his mother and his brethren stood without, desiring to speak with them. Then one said unto him, behold, thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to speak with thee." So you see, here's Jesus, and in the course of his ministry, he is talking to the multitude, and on this occasion, his mother and his brethren come along in order to have a discussion with him. Why did they want to have a discussion with him? Well, in Mark's Gospel, which we won't turn up, but Mark chapter 3 verse 21 says that his relations said of Jesus at this time, "He is beside himself," which is a sort of nice way to say he's gone potty. They felt that the rising popularity of Jesus was such that the fame of it all had gone to Christ's head, and that the Lord had become a little bit unbalanced. They felt that in the heat of the moment that there was a little bit of mental instability here. "Look, he's beside himself," they said, and so they decided to go and to speak to the Lord. Now, I believe it was the brethren of Christ that instigated that, because we're told, aren't we, later in John chapter 7, that his own brethren didn't believe in him. But you see, what they did is they got Mary, the mother, on side. They said, "Look, Mum, we've got a problem with Jesus. He's just about beside himself. We've got to do something." And Mary's mother love and her natural anxiety for Jesus was swayed by the brethren into joining them and coming with them. So here they are, verse 46. "While he yet talked to the people, behold, his mother and his brethren stood without, desiring to speak to him." Now, there was nothing wrong with Mary wanting to speak to Jesus. Nothing wrong with that at all. But the problem was, what did she want to speak about? And you see, she wanted to speak about flesh and blood relations. You know what she was going to say? Not actually in the text, but I know what she said, you see. She was going to say, "Son, you need a break. Why don't you come home with Mum for a while? Come on." Can you see Mary saying that? She wanted to protect him. She wanted to look after him. She wanted to mother him, just for a while. "Come on, come home, son, for a while. It's all getting a bit much, isn't it?" So here, but you see how significant verse 46 is. You see that, you see every word's powerful. His mother and his brethren, look at this, stood without. Ah, there's the problem. There's the whole problem. You see, his mother's there, but she stands outside the circle of his disciples. That's the whole problem. She's outside the circle of the spiritual relationship that he now has with his disciples. He has a spiritual tie with these people, not a flesh and blood one, and she is outside that circle. Now, you see, the lesson of that was that because she stood without, outside the spiritual circle of the relationship that he had with his disciples, you see, the problem with this is that Christ could never have gone to her, could he? She had to come to him. You see, Mary stood on the outside and expected Jesus to come out for a chat. But when you think about what that symbolized, Jesus could never have gone out to meet his mother. She had to come to him. Isn't that the whole lesson of this story? Now just stop and think how this actually would have happened. Can you imagine the message? Here you are. Here's this throng of people, this multitude, Jesus perhaps on a slight rise in the middle, standing there, exhorting the multitude. And here's the mother and the brethren who arrive on the outside. No way of getting in. Now, how do you get a message through? Well, you tap someone on the shoulder. Look, I wonder if you'd mind passing this message on. You do pass a message in to say that Jesus' mother's outside. I would like to have a chat to him and his brethren. Pass it on. Tap, 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 tap. They can see it all going in. There's all the shoulders. And finally, right in the front, verse 47 says, and he's the last one to get the message, then one said unto him. Now, he was the one right in front of Jesus. He got a... Yes. Jesus, mother's outside. Oh, right. He steps forward, and Mary on the outside sees the man stepping forward to Jesus. Your mother's outside. I'd like to have a word to you. You see that happen? And verse 48 says, but he answered and said unto him that told him, who is my mother? Oh, what a sword thrust this was going to be. Who is my mother and who are my brethren? And he stretched forth his hand to... Now just look at all the key words here before we turn over the page. Don't turn over the page. Now look, what are the key words here? Remember the key words are, what are the words again? Father, mother, son, brethren, disciples. Now here's one of them, verse 46. His mother and his brethren stood without. Mother and brethren. Verse 49, he stretched forth his hand towards his disciples. Over the page. Verse 50, and said, for whoever shall do the will of my Father. There's the other word. Now you see all those terms of relationship coming out in this record again. There they all are. Here's the whole conflict. A spiritual relationship or a fleshly one. Whose son is this boy? He's not your son any longer, Mary. And you've got to come to him as the Son of God. Now you imagine how that message would have hurt Mary, because what actually probably happened, you see, was, you see, she saw the man go forward to address Jesus, and then she sees Jesus stretch forth his hands and turn around to the multitude, stretched out his hands, it says, to the disciples. And then he said, you pass that message back out again. Tap, 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 tap. What does he say? Well, Jesus says to tell you that his mother and his brethren are those that do the will of his Father in heaven. Oh, wouldn't that have hurt Mary? Can you imagine that? On the outside of the crowd. Ooh, what a sword thrust that was. But the Lord had to do that, didn't he? She had to get over this problem of her relationship to this boy and to see him in a different light altogether. Those that do the will of my Father in heaven. That's the only thing finally that matters. Verse 50. You know, there's a principle that comes out of that, and that's this. That we should never allow maternal feelings or paternal feelings for that matter, to override divine principles. We should never ever allow our feelings as mothers or fathers to override divine principles. At the end of the day, in the truth, the sole and final judge of what we do is it in accordance with the Father's will? That's all. That's it. You know, the spirit of this is all found in Psalm 69. Father, mother, brethren, disciples, son. Psalm 69, verse 8. I am become a stranger unto my brethren, and an alien unto my mother's children, for the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. See what Psalm 69, verse 8 says? I am become a stranger. He didn't seek to be a stranger. He didn't want to be a stranger to his brethren or his mother. He became such because he was committed to the Father's purpose and they weren't. It happened as a process because he'd risen to the theme of God manifestation and they couldn't see God manifest in him. And so what he didn't ask for, what he didn't want, became. I am become a stranger. And notice this verse 8. Notice what you see, you've got to read carefully, don't you? Because you see what verse 8 says. I am become an alien unto my mother's children. He would never be a stranger to his father's children. Because his father's children were his disciples. Never made strange from them. It's the mother's children that he's alienated from. And the mother's in it together with them. It's the mother and the children involved in this alienation together. Unless Mary can see him as the Son of God, she will always stand without, still desiring to speak to him. And I suppose the other good thing, the positive thing that emerges from that, is the fact that we are able to develop relationships in the truth that are based on spiritual ties, even if we don't have family in the truth. Some people come in from outside and they haven't got families. They haven't got mums and dads in the truth, or grandmas or grandpas. It doesn't matter. In the truth, we have. In the truth, we're able to develop spiritual ties and spiritual relationships, because the ecclesia is now our family. Now you see how those words are all woven into the story. Father, mother, son, brethren. It goes round and round over those words all the time, doesn't it? The struggle in Mary's heart to see who Jesus really was. Here's the last one. John 19. Verse 25. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. You know, you can understand Mary being there, can't you? This was her boy. And although it must have been a terrible thing for a mother to see a son crucified on a stake, she wanted to be there. Right to the end. Her heart racked with grief. Her mind numb with the horror of it all. Her ears reddened with the salty tears that had coursed down her face. But she's there all the same. Besides the cross of Jesus stood his mother. Verse 26. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by, whom he loved, he said unto his mother, "Woman." Oh, there's that word again. Still didn't call her mother, did he? Even now. "Woman, behold thy son." Now, when he said "behold thy son" in verse 26, what do you think he meant? He said unto his mother, "Woman." Oh, there's that word again. Still didn't call her mother, did he? Even now. "Woman, behold thy son." Now, when he said "behold thy son" in verse 26, what do you think he meant? Was he asking Mary to look upon him? What did Jesus mean when he said "behold thy son" in verse 26? Sorry? Hands up those that agree with that. Well, you're right. Now read it carefully. Look at it. "When he saw his mother and the disciples standing by whom he loved, he said unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. And he said to the disciple, Disciple, behold thy mother." You see how there's a complete interchange here. He said to the disciple, "Behold thy mother." He said to the woman, "Behold thy son." And so what he did was he invited Mary to look upon John now and to regard him as the son that would look after him, after her. And then he invited John to look upon his mother and to regard her as his mother and to look after her. So he invited them into a new relationship together that they might care for one another and comfort one another after he was gone. But you see all the key words there. And this time, you've got the two relationships brought together. You've got son, mother, and disciple. Spiritual relationship with the disciple that most loved him. And how does John's Gospel finish, by the way? I'm treating chapter 20 as the conclusion. It says, doesn't it? "And many other things," said Jesus, "which are not written in this book, but these are written, that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God." John had a conviction on that, didn't he? Jesus says to Mary, "You go and live with him." There was wise provision in that, of course, because Jesus' own brethren, the Lord's brethren, didn't yet believe on him, and I think that he specifically asked John to take care of his mother so that she didn't have to go back into the hostility of his own home. And no doubt Mary would be able to unfold all the things she'd stored in her heart from the early days of Jesus, and John would be able to reflect on the ministry of the Lord and tell her many of the things that had happened in the course of his ministry. And between the two of them, they would draw forth many thoughts. And what do you think Mary would learn out of all of that? Well, I think it was the lesson that she had to learn as she stood at the cross here, and that is this. And maybe she never heard these words, by the way. She might have been led away by John before she ever heard these words, which we know he was to utter shortly before he died. But the conviction that finally came upon Mary, and I think this was the final piercing sword thrust on this occasion, was this: that whatever part she had played, whatever moment she might have been involved, however she had been part of the birth and raising of this boy, that at his death, she finally understood, in the words of someone else, truly this was the Son of God. And shortly afterwards, Jesus was to say, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit." Isn't that what she had to learn? That this was Emmanuel. "He that loveth, she that loveth son more than me is not worthy of me." She had to learn to come to him as the Son of God and not as her own boy. Must have been a very hard struggle. Can't you sympathise with Mary in that? Can't you understand the problem that she must have had in that? Because she naturally had an affinity to this child. And the very natural affinity she had was the greatest stumbling block that she had to overcome to appreciate the work of Messiah. She had to encounter many a sword thrust before she got there. But we believe she finally did. And what a marvellous thing it was that she saw him, no doubt, as a resurrected man. See her son forever beyond mortality and suffering, the first truly immortalized being, to recognize that her son was the firstborn amongst many brethren. What a marvellous thing it would have been for Mary to know all that. And look how the story closed. Isn't it always nice to have a nice close to a story? Well, here's the conclusion chapter of this story in Acts chapter 1. Because in Acts chapter 1, we have in verse 13, when they were come in, they went up into an upper room where abode both Peter and James and John and Andrew and Philip and Thomas and Bartholomew and Matthew and James the son of Alphaeus and Simon Zelotes and Judas the brother of James. Who are they, by the way? The apostles. These all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the woman, and look at this, and with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brethren. And in those days Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples. Oh, you see all those words there again? The mother of Jesus, the brethren of Jesus. But where are they all now? They're all together in the midst of the disciples of Jesus. He's joined the ecclesia. And so is a prison. They've all come in together. They've all seen whose son Messiah is. But it took Mary a long time to get there and many a sword thrust to learn that lesson. Well, that's the story of Mary. Only part of the story, of course, but that certainly seems to be a thread, doesn't it, that runs through her life. Concerning this one, we read in a hymn, "Earth for him had groaned and travailed since the ages first began, for in him was hid the secret that through all the ages ran, son of Mary, son of David, son of God, and son of man."